I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:31 p.m. on Friday, February 15th, 2019. We're meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phone as a courtesy. Committee members in attendance today are Senator Geisel, Senator Stevens, and myself, Senator Wilson. Senator Coghill and Senator Begich are excused for today. Before the committee this afternoon, we have Senate Bill 7, Medicaid Assistance Work Requirement by Senator Michicki. This is our first time hearing the bill. The plan today is we'll hear the bill from the bill sponsor, take public testimony, and my intent is to hold this bill over. Also, we want to recognize the Deputy Commissioner from the Department of Labor, Kathy Munez, is here today in the audience. We have Senator Michicki and his staff, Edra Morledge, here at the table to present the bill, and you guys may begin at your convenience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Peter Michicki, District O, I appreciate you and the committee hearing this bill today. Edra, do you want to introduce yourself?
Okay. Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Michicki.
So, Mr. Chairman, this bill is about opportunity. Let me first say that this is taking the long view toward breaking a negative cycle, in my view. Senate Bill 7 answers one question, which is, should Alaskans who receive Medicaid benefits have the requirement to work? I think the answer is yes. And Senate Bill 7 is a direct path to achieving that end and realizing that opportunity. This bill is the result of an announcement by the Center for Medicaid Services, CMS, allowing work requirements by states under the structure of the federal 1115 waiver. This waiver is intended to allow states to approve experimental, pilot, or demonstration projects that give states additional flexibility to design and improve their Medicaid programs. Before we go into the mechanics of the bill, Mr. Chairman, and what it hopes to achieve, let me go through some of the facts that have been in question surrounding work requirements for Medicaid recipients. First, Senate Bill 7 does not require the elderly, the disabled, or new mothers to work to get their health benefits. It also requires that a recipient with a substance abuse disorder is able to obtain appropriate treatment and that the work requirements do not interfere with that treatment. The bill also provides for exemptions for individuals who are not employed, volunteering, or otherwise exempt if they're in an education or training program that will lead to employment. In fact, there's an extensive list of exemptions on page 2, lines 6 through 21. There's also a chart in your packet that illustrates all the exemptions to the work volunteer requirements. With Senate Bill 7, we're going to join 16 other states that are moving forward with similar Medicaid requirements, somewhat of a moving target as this number is constantly increasing. Since 2015, there's been success and a huge increase in the number of Medicaid recipients in Alaska. I believe the current estimate is nearly 210,000 people, Alaskans, but Hess can confirm. Senate Bill 7 will apply to a relatively small portion of these individuals, specifically those that can work but do not. And some folks have assumed that work requirements for Medicaid recipients is mainly about saving money. Frankly, in the short term, Mr. Chairman, I don't see that this legislation will save a significant amount of money. I think it's going to be somewhat of a break even. But think about the long-term view. Think about what it'll be like to break the cycle for not only those that will become employed, but their children and grandchildren that break that cycle of some families that have struggled to find employment for a very long time. There are other states that have developed creative incentives to get their Medicaid recipients back to work. I see this legislation as a conversation starter here in Alaska to just that. But again, Senate Bill 7 is not designed necessarily as an immediate spending reduction bill, but rather a way to encourage people to join the community of people who contribute every day to make Alaska a better place to live. It is hope, however, that getting people to work and off government roles will in fact lead to savings in the long term. It will encourage folks to get out and work, get involved in the larger workforce population, become engaged in their communities, build skills, get experience, build confidence, and connect with others that are doing the same. They should be able to use those positive experiences to work themselves out of the Medicaid system in the longer term. Some may view Senate Bill 7 as a philosophical bill, but I think it should be the default position of Americans and Alaskans that those who can work should work. Mr. Chairman, I see this as an opportunity. The way that I view it is we don't know if the next person to cure cancer or to be the very best in whatever field they choose is not relying on the state to carry them through every day, missing that opportunity to be the very best they can be, not only for themselves, but as an example for their families and communities. My staff, Edra Morledge, can go through the sectional analysis of the bill, and folks from the Department of Health and Social Services are here to speak to the specifics of how such a program would be implemented.
Ms. Morledge?
Thank you. For the record, Edra Morledge again, staff to Senator Machicki. I'm just going to make a couple of remarks about how the Section 1115 waiver works and how we got to where we're at today with the introduction of this legislation. As Senator Machicki mentioned, SB 7 is a bill that would direct the State Department of Health and Social Services to apply for a Section 1115 waiver from the federal government to implement work requirements as a condition of continued eligibility for Medicaid coverage in our able-bodied population. For those of you that might not be familiar with waivers and how new programs are implemented in the Medicaid program, a Section 1115 is a pretty broad waiver. Some of the waivers we've been using in our state Medicaid program have been granted under the 1115 waivers. And it's just a way, really, to ask the federal government to sort of bend the rules to specifics that we face here in Alaska. For the first time, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has changed their policy and will accept waivers that test the hypothesis that requiring work or community engagement as a condition of eligibility will result in more beneficiaries being employed or engaging in other productive activities. The goal is that this will result in increased health and well-being for the beneficiaries and our communities. In April of last year, the President signed an executive order titled Reducing Poverty in America, which is intended to promote economic mobility, strong social networks, and accountability. The executive order has a strong focus on work requirements for work-capable people. As Senator Machicki mentioned, SB 7 includes many exemptions, which you have a chart of, and it's also listed on page 2. And I'll go through those in the sectional, which I can start right now. And also, as he mentioned, it's a small, sort of narrow band of folks on Medicaid that this bill is targeting. I think the estimate is probably somewhere between 20,000 to 25,000 folks.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'm being asked to join Judiciary, who needs a quorum. As I exit, though, and I will come back as soon as possible, you're going to hear arguments in this bill about such things as we're asking people to find employment in places where there's no work. When you look at the gap that we have in our fiscal crisis, Mr. Chairman, I believe that the volunteer requirement where perhaps work is not available could significantly reduce the cost of what the state is providing in services as these people become more engaged, gain skills, gain confidence. So when you look at the fiscal note, again, this is a long-term view. It is absent of those significant benefits across the state, particularly in rural areas, that I expect, and studies have shown across the country, will occur if such a bill is put in place. With that, Mr. Chairman.
Do you mind answering a quick question from
yes,
Senator
no.
Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if I misunderstood you or not, Senator Machicki. You used the figure 210,000. Were you saying that there are 210,000 people who are Medicaid recipients? Is that, which means it's about a quarter of Alaskans, every fourth person in Alaska, something like that?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, the reality of it is we live in a state where less than half of us work. A third of us are on Medicaid, essentially. And more than half of the children born in Alaska last year were born under Medicaid. And I don't say that as a way to be disparaging of folks that are in need of medical help. I'm just wanting to provide opportunities so that they don't spend a lifetime counting on those kinds of services. They learn to provide for themselves and to be to accomplish the most they can possibly accomplish in their lifetimes.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would you please continue with the...
Okay. Thank you. Edra Moreledge again. And so I'll start with this sectional analysis now. This is a one-section bill, so I'll go through the subsections of the bill. First of all, beginning on page 1, lines 6 through 9, this amends statute 4707036. It adds a new subsection H, which directs the Department of Health and Social Services to apply for the Section 1115 waiver of the Social Security Act to establish work requirements for adults in the Medicaid program who do not meet the criteria to be exempt for those requirements. Subsection 1, also beginning on page 1, line 10, it requires an able-bodied Medicaid recipient to engage in work activities for a minimum of 20 hours each week. Activities in which a person is actively seeking employment, participating in an education or training program, volunteering, caregiving, or engaging in subsistence activities also would count towards the 20-hour work requirement. Subsection 2, beginning on page 2, line 2, states that if a Medicaid recipient is also receiving benefits under the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program, or ATAP, and is in compliance with the work requirements listed under the Alaska Statute 4727035, then they automatically meet the new work requirements in this bill. Subsection 3, beginning on page 2, line 6, provides for a list of exemptions to the work requirement, and they begin with Subsection A, children or the elderly, which means under 18 and 65 or over. B, the parent or caretaker, of a dependent child of up to 12 months of age, and the parent or caretaker is providing home care for the child. C, the parent or caretaker of a child experiencing a disability, and the parent or caretaker is providing home care for the child. D, the caretaker of a relative who is experiencing a disability and requires 24-hour care. E, the parent or caretaker of a child under 6, and the parent or caretaker demonstrates that appropriate child care is not available. F, the recipient is unable to work for medical reasons as determined by a licensed medical professional. G, the recipient is pregnant, and this is a requirement by the CMS guidance letter to states. H, they are currently receiving unemployment insurance benefits, and that particular program has its own work requirements, so we were trying not to be duplicative in this bill. I, they're participating in a tribal work program. That's also required by the CMS guidance letter. And this list of exemptions are modeled after our current temporary assistance program. And the guidance letter from CMS. And in that guidance letter, they asked us to line up our work requirements for various programs. So that's what we were attempting to do with that list. Subsection 4, beginning on page 2, line 22, provides for temporary exemptions for a parent or caretaker who is experiencing a family hardship outside of their control for the duration of the hardship. And subsection B, for someone who is a victim of domestic violence. And both of those temporary hardships line up with the existing TANF program, which is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Subsection 5, beginning on line 28 of page 2, ensures that the work requirements do not prevent a Medicaid recipient from seeking treatment for substance abuse. Not only is that required by the CMS guidance letter, but we recognize that our state is still in the midst of a significant drug addiction and or ongoing substance abuse issues. And we wanted to make sure that any work requirement would not stop people from seeking and receiving the treatment that they need. And finally, subsection 6, beginning on page 2, line 31, the section sets up a notification process for all Medicaid recipients once the 1115 waiver is approved, and a 90-day notification of noncompliance with the work requirements before benefits are terminated. And that concludes the sectional analysis.
All right.
Are there any questions of committee members at this time?
Ms. March, I have a couple of questions in terms of the bill, sir, of why, and feel free to get back to the committee. I understand that Senator had other state business to attend to. The age requirements of why 65 was chosen. You know, we've heard that most of the average age of the state workers, just when you're talking about the state workers, are between the ages of 41 to about 44, and that 65 may be a little high to have a work requirement of that.
Well, first of all, I believe that that is contained in the guidance letter from the Center of Medicaid and Medicare Services, but I'll double check on that and verify that for you. This bill itself was also modeled after some legislation that the that was before the legislature in a previous legislature. But I'll double check on where that exactly came from, but I believe it's in the guidance letter.
Okay. I mean, so the guidance, I mean, does it mind if that age is lowered in terms of age 65, if we can look at lowering that age a little bit? Or does it have to be in consistency with other requirements of our other work programs that we have set forth, similarly to the age of a child up to 12 months of a parent or caretaker in the home? I think some other states have raised that cap to school-bearing age kids. I know we have a lot of questions and concerns from folks that submitted their written testimony on that as well. And then lastly, we had some comments upon participating in sort of, you have an exemption for the tribal work program, but another state, I believe Arizona, has an exemption for tribal beneficiaries of federally recognized tribes.
Okay. Chair Wilson, Edra Morledge again. I will check on the flexibility, but I believe it's built in. I believe it's in the guidance letter that states are allowed a generous amount of flexibility for what works in their states, but I'll look into that and get back to the committee members.
Okay. Yes, Senator Geisler, let me just I just want to let the committee members know that Sandra O'Brien, Director of Public Assistance, available for questions, as well as Donna Sherwood, Deputy Director of Department of Health and Social Services, also is available for questions, too. Senator Geisler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Ms. Etheridge, the states that have successfully implemented, I understand that Michigan and Maine were recently approved. Ohio, I think, has been functioning for a while. Could you give us the names of the states that have their programs approved?
Through the chair, Senator Geisler, you should have in your packet, but I will look at it right now.
Okay.
I believe the most recent information that I was able to get my hands on, which listed 16 states that are either in the process and have applications pending or have been approved.
Right, just to refine the question, I'm interested in the ones that have gotten them approved. I understand there's quite a few applying.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Geisler, this is Edra Morledge again. What I'm showing is Arizona, Arkansas, Indiana, Kentucky, Maine, Michigan, New Hampshire, and a portion of Utah's waiver.
Okay, so Ohio was not one of them. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay.
So tagging on to what Mr. Chairman was just asking about the age cap, you know, the 65 and so forth, how do the programs that have been approved compare on the age range, 18 to, do you have any idea what their upper age was?
Through the chair, Senator Geisler, this is Edra Morledge again for the record. I looked into a couple of different states, and they vary widely. And I know that Arkansas, I believe it was in response to some pending lawsuits, ended up doing something. I think it was like they raised the age of 18 to 19, and then they lowered the upper cap down significantly. It's somewhere in the 50s. So it's kind of all over the board. So I do believe the flexibility is there if that's what you're after. But I'll look into further other states and see how far that is varying.
Mr. Chairman, that's kind of what I'm looking at is these were programs that were approved by Medicaid, or by CMS, that is, and have successfully endured challenges, and so it'd probably be good to follow in their footsteps to some degree. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. At this time, if there's no further questions, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just so I'll have a better understanding of this, is there anything in this bill that really relates to helping folks that are trying to get in the jobs, into jobs? Anything in this bill actually relate to helping folks find jobs? Or are we dealing with other programs that would do that?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, this is Edra Moreledge again. There's nothing in this bill that relates to any sort of finding employment assistance, but I know that Senator Machicki is open to any and all suggestions to accomplish that end.
Follow-up, Senator?
Thank you. I'm not trying to expand this bill, but I think it's worthwhile knowing what are those programs that are going on that we in the state that we do help people find jobs.
Sure. Senator Stevens, through the chair, I don't know specifically the answer to that question, but I believe we have some folks from the Department of Labor here that might be able to address that.
Great. Thank you.
Did the Deputy Commissioner or her designee like to address some of those programs?
Hello, Chair Wilson. James Harvey, Assistant Director for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Division of Employment and Training Services.
If you could respond to Senator Stevens' questions about what type of work programs the state currently has to help people find employment, gain, or case management services that can help folks retain jobs after they find that employment.
Sure. through the chair, Senator Stevens. The job center system that we operate in the state currently has 14 concrete offices, but we operate also on an internet basis. And so there are several opportunities that we allow for engagement in the process of job seeking. Most of it is voluntary, so individuals seeking work actively and given those tools to do so. One of the main things that we have at our disposal is our Alaska State Labor Exchange System, and that is simply that. It's a job posting, job matching board for Alaska's employers to connect with Alaska's job seekers. In the case of unemployment insurance claimants, which is noted as an exemption in this category here, those individuals are required to register in that system, have a full online resume, and do active job searches depending upon their placement within a claimant status. For other individuals not compelled to do that, of course, it's, again, simply voluntary. There are other programs throughout the state system, notably in the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Public Assistance, with their TANF program, which is also mentioned in this bill. That program allows for individuals to be in the program, have some case management experience provided by division staff and DPA or their contractors, and they set case management goals for those individuals. Again, that is a compelled status for those individuals. Back to the category of individuals of voluntary status, we have several programs in the state of Alaska that we operate, the main funding streams that we use in our job centers to provide the labor exchange services and the employment and training services for individuals, such as resume preparation, interview assistance, mock interviewing, skills coaching, identification of occupational goals, possibly skills attainment if skills are a barrier to employment for that individual. And so through the job center system, which includes the majority of the partners that we're talking about here, such as public assistance programs, definitely Division of Employment and Training Services programs, Division of Vocational Rehabilitation programs, Alaska Housing Finance programs, are all considered partners in this workforce system. And each program may benefit individuals that are eligible for those programs. And so there's a myriad of those at the disposal for individuals, whether they're compelled or not compelled.
Any follow-up additional questions, Senator?
I'm just trying to get my head around this, Mr. Chairman. I've never been without a job in my entire life, I don't think, from the age of, 12 or 13. And I know how to get a job if the worst comes to worst. But are we talking about people, a third of Alaskans, who have never had a job in their life? And how can we help them to find employment? I know some of the programs you've mentioned would do that, but we haven't succeeded yet. And we have a third of Alaskans without a job. So how is this going to improve things?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens. I can't explicitly comment on the subset of the population. Obviously, the 200,000 number was put forth as individuals participating in Medicaid, with an estimation of somewhere between 20 and 25,000 individuals that may fall into this group. Of that group, there's a number of individuals that are working. And of that group, there's a number of those individuals that have demonstrated work through the fact that they're receiving unemployment insurance benefits. You cannot receive unemployment insurance without having prior work. So in addressing that, as yet at this point, to me, unknown number of individuals who have never worked, we do that on a daily basis. We have individuals that come in with little to no experience all of the time. Many of those generally are younger adult Alaskans, and we work well with them. In fact, one of the programs that comprises the workforce system is the WIOA, or Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, youth program. And through that program that's administered in our department, in our division, we use grantees throughout the state to engage providers that work with at-risk youth, either in school or out of school. And so from that concept alone, with individuals with little to no work history, there's headway made. And daily there's headway made with individuals at differing age targets. There was some discussion before about individuals at 65 or older. We also operate a program for individuals that are 55 or older. It's, for our state, it's called the Mature Alaskan Seeking Skills Training. And what we'll do with individuals in that meet eligibility for that program is that we will help to place them into a work environment where they will learn real work skills that they can then translate in and apply for and achieve unsubsidized employment elsewhere. So daily, we collectively in the workforce system, not just the job centers, but the hardworking individuals that represent these programs in places like DPA and AHSC as well, are working with individuals that have little to no work experience.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You told me this committee would be an education, and it certainly has been. Thank you.
And, you know, really, I mean, we have about seven different, what I've heard today is that we have about seven different work programs and crossing technically four different departments that are working towards similar goals initiatives. Has there ever been a look at consolidation of sort of the workforce development system in our state?
To the chair. That action is actually federally driven, and it's ongoing, and it's actually not ongoing. It's put in place in what's called the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. And that act defines out the required partner programs underneath that act, WIOA, as we call it. And those partnerships exist, and we work collaboratively together, whether it's program to program or by serving our participants in a co-enrollment manner. And it's manifested in many places through the relationships that are found through their localized job center system. As far as repetitiveness or crossing over, these programs are, in many cases, offered many different varieties of services to individuals. So where one program may offer services very specifically to dislocated workers, individuals that have lost their job through no fault of their own, another program, such as that with AHSC, might be more tightly trained on those individuals that are receiving assistance through that program. And similarly here, it references the TANF program, and that's very specific for those individuals receiving TANF benefits. Some of those programs, there's a compelling factor involved for the individuals to be engaged in those programs, and so they're structured and built in that manner. Whereas other programs, such as I mentioned the Dislocated Worker Program, those are out there for the benefit of individuals that are compelled on their own or under their own desire to seek this change, seek the job, seek the additional skills attainment.
All right. Let me rephrase, sorry, my statement then a question with this then. So a few years back, I worked for an agency that had two of these work service programs in the Mat-Su. They're all within about a mile and a half on the Parks Highway in a centralized location, and none of them were at full capacity of serving their clientele, specific clientele, but they all did very similar type of work services. And it just seemed at that time, and seems now, that we could do better as a state to sort of try to look what we can do to cross those barriers of lines of service to weeks so we can help these individuals, so as we can look at consolidating programs that the end user would see no difference. And I know we're getting off from the subject here, and we'll get back on task here, because we do have quite a few folks to testify. But I mean, that's all. I'm just looking to ask the state and the Department of Labor, Department of Pests. You know, we got prisoner reentry, workforce development, Department of Housing Finance Corporation. There's a lot of services out there to help people get to work, but it just seems a more coordinated approach would be a better use of resources for our state to help our fellow Alaskans. And that's just a comment. You don't have to reply to that, and we will move on here. I do have a question for our HESS folks that are online. If you can briefly, you don't have to go over the fiscal note that we have, but we do have, I believe, 9 or 10 notes. If you can just give a summary of the overall cost, and if this were to pass in the legislation, what do you feel would be the active timeline of getting a program up and ready?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Shonda O'Brien. I am the Director of Public Assistance. So in summary, the fiscal notes before you contain costs we believe would be necessary to implement the bill. Excuse me. We believe that there will be some savings offset by those recipients who might not be in compliance with the bill, and you'll see those in the Medicaid-related fiscal notes. For the administrative costs, you'll see those in fiscal notes for public assistance specifically. There will be certain elements to administering the program similar to how we do with the TANF program now. So we estimated our costs based off of case management for what we already know the staffing needs are for that program. There's also a fiscal note in the work services program where you'll see the supported services pieces. Those are the costs related to job aids, some of the barriers for folks to receiving employment or working might be different training programs or other supported services needs. Sometimes it's clothing, sometimes it's tools, sometimes it's things in the way of childcare. So you'll see there are some average costs per person built in. Those costs are just averaged out based on what we already know the work services program costs us for TANF.
Do you have a total cost number?
Total cost number in summary for all the fiscal notes?
Yes, ma'am.
I didn't total it up before we came here, so I would say just looking at the fiscal notes in front of me, I think they almost even out for the first year. We see in FY20.
And we'll take a brief at ease here.
Thank you.
Excuse me. For the record, Edra Morledge again. This is a document that I received from the Department of Health and Social Services, and so it lists out the what each of the fiscal notes, the amounts, and which division sections that they are for.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, explanation of what?
Yes, if we can go through this in a little bit more detail, it would be wonderful.
All right. For the record, again, Shonda O'Brien, Director for the Division of Public Assistance. So in FY20, our net savings is estimated to be about $17.9 million. That takes into consideration where we expect to see savings in the Medicaid services components. So the estimations are based off of what we believe will be the group of people who may be in noncompliance. And those numbers are calculated based off of just an estimate of the overall enrollment, the number of people required to participate, and then based on what we've seen in other similar programs across the state as well as across the nation. So just kind of looking at how other states have implemented their work requirements and what they've seen for results. In the years beyond FY 2021, that overall net savings has changed. Let's see, in FY 2021, it looks like it's about $8.8 million overall. And then beyond FY 2022, the savings kind of level out at about $18 million. And so at some point in time, we believe that the numbers of people enrolled in the program and the numbers of individuals new entering to the program are going to level off. We're not going to see a whole lot of change in the out years to the number of people that are participating and required to participate.
Okay. Thank you. And a time, so let's say if this was enacted into law, how long would it take your department to get fully staffed and implement a program of this nature?
Mr. Chair, the we estimate that it's going to take a little bit of time to get the approval, first of all, from CMS to do the waiver. Sometimes those waivers can be approved in as little as a few months, but more often than not, it takes several months, sometimes even years, to get approval. Considering that there are other states implementing work requirements, we are hopeful that we can mirror our request similar to other states and hopefully expedite that approval process. That being said, in a perfect world where all of our approvals are in place and our regulations can be updated accordingly, we estimate that it would take probably 6 months to get staffed fully and get those staff trained appropriately to administer the program. We believe that our existing case management system has the capacity to take on this additional work presently. We do believe that within the next few years, we're going to have to replace that system, regardless of whether this work requirement is passed, just because of attrition, just because of other reasons with our systems. And so we expect that somewhere in the next 2 years, we would need a new case management system, and we would build that into our capital request at that time.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? You're seeing none. Thank you guys for your testimony. And we will open it up to public testimony. We'll first start here with the folks in the room in Juneau. We have Jeannie Monk, and then next followed by Allison Curry. And Jeannie, with the number of folks here, we'll plan on 2 minutes for your testimony.
Okay, great. Thanks. For the record, my name is Jeannie Monk. I'm Senior Vice President with the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Thanks for the chance to provide some comments. ASHNA understands and appreciates the interest in workforce engagement in Alaska, and we agree with efforts to support Alaskans being part of the workforce, to engage in education and training so they can contribute to the economy. I really appreciate the sponsor being clear about the defining the goal, that it's not about saving money but about engaging people in the workforce, and that there are a number of very important exemptions provided. However, we are opposed to SB 7 currently in its current form. We are willing to work with the sponsor of the committee to improve this legislation to address some of our concerns, but we do have a number of reasons why we are concerned about the proposed legislation. New Medicaid eligibility standards, unless they're very carefully crafted to avoid unintended consequences, could result in restricting needed access to health care for Alaskans who have jobs, who have disabilities, chronic illnesses, or other health care needs. The majority of Alaskan adults who are enrolled in Medicaid are working, but many work in low-wage jobs that don't provide health insurance. So these part-time, low-wage jobs often have varying hours. They may be full-time, but their hours vary. They may have high rates of involuntary part-time work and are very inflexible. If I have a sick child right now and have to take time off from work to take my child to the doctor or to be home with them, I don't have to worry about losing my job. But many people in inflexible jobs are in that position, and we would add to the stress of their lives by putting these requirements in place. Losing health care coverage can make it harder for Alaskans to work. What we're talking about, the $17.9 million they said we would save, we're really talking about a cost shift. We're saying that those people, their health needs are still real. So their health needs won't go away. Their coverage will, and those health needs will be absorbed by somebody within our health system, probably in the most expensive place health care can be received, in the emergency room. So we have concerns about taking the coverage away from people who are already, many of them, working. We also are concerned about adding another layer of administrative paperwork to the program that already has a huge backlog and burden in processing Medicaid applications. So right now, we just don't believe the program lacks the capacity to implement and assess additional eligibility requirements. We also have some concerns about the lack of detail in the legislation and believe it's important to provide more guidance to DHSS on the development and implementation of the work requirements and more clearly identify how support will be provided to help people find employment, training, or volunteer opportunities. So we do think there are options to improve this legislation, looking at other states, and we've specifically looked at Michigan as one example. Michigan, for example, has a very robust IT system, and they allow people to report online on a monthly basis their work activities. Also, Michigan started out with a requirement of 20 hours per week, which seems on the surface to make sense, and then moved to a hours per month. So rather than requiring people to demonstrate every week that they've worked 20 hours, they move to 80 hours per month, which better accommodates shifting work schedules. We believe it's important to provide some kind of an allowance for seasonal workers. Alaska's tourism and fishing industry means that people in many areas of the state may work 40 hours or more for several months, followed by weeks or months of no work. And despite their total number of hours and demonstrated commitment to the work process, they could lose their health benefits due to the inconsistencies.
You can wrap up.
Okay. So we have some other suggestions we'd be happy to provide. If the committee wants to work towards work engagement requirements, we just urge you to be very careful to create well-designed, efficient program that will encourage work engagement while maintaining health care benefits for Alaskans and their families.
Thank you. Next up is Ms. Allison Curry, followed by Aaron Walker Tullis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Allison Curry. I'm the legislative liaison with Planned Parenthood Votes and also a Juneau resident, and am here today to also express concerns and oppose Senate Bill 7. Planned Parenthood works to ensure everybody has access to the health care they need, regardless of their income or their circumstances. Approximately a quarter of our patients are Medicaid recipients, and nearly 90% are women. And the enrollment restrictions in Senate Bill 7 would decrease access to health care in our state and would have a disproportionate impact on women, so the very patients we serve. Medicaid covers 1 in 5 women of reproductive age and is the source of coverage for nearly half of women giving birth. It also covers a range of preventive care that is crucial for women's well-being. I'd like to reiterate that most Medicaid enrollees who can work already do. When Medicaid enrollees do not work, it's typically because they face barriers to work like transportation, housing, job training and availability, and education. And while this bill contains some exemptions, they are inadequate and vague. These work requirements and the administrative burden of seeking exemptions would result in even eligible enrollees losing basic preventive care they depend on without improving their economic stability, which we have seen in some of the other states who have implemented work requirements, like in Arkansas that was mentioned in testimony earlier. And that's why research has shown that work requirements don't actually decrease poverty, but instead can push families even deeper into poverty. This bill would also harm our state budget. We know that investing in preventive care is highly cost-effective, and the state saves $7 for every dollar it invests in family planning. In short, if this bill were to pass, our state would end up spending more money to provide less access to health care. We respectfully ask the committee to oppose Senate Bill 7 and instead invest in proven, cost-effective strategies to improve access to health care and economic security. Thank you very much for your consideration of our comments.
Thank you. Next up is Aaron Walker Tullis. You can state your name and affiliation for the record and plan about 2 minutes for your testimony, please.
Thank you so much for having me here today. My name is Aaron Walker Tullis. I'm the Executive Director of Catholic Community Service, a faith-based regional nonprofit serving all of Southeast Alaska. I also happen to have a lot of experience working for public assistance for many years, and my most recent position before this one with Catholic Community Service was Chief of Policy and Program Development for the Division of Public Assistance, as well as the TANF Director and SNAP Director, so I'm very familiar with the work requirements involved with TANF. I'd like to say that I'd echo Ms. Monk's comments from Ashna. I think she was spot on all of her comments. So, but rather than repeat that, I'll add to the list. I think I'm most concerned about, in addition to what Ms. Monk noted, is rural Alaskans. What we found when we were implementing work requirements for families on TANF is that there were simply no volunteer opportunities available in rural Alaska. The time it took to try to develop those positions, those opportunities, required a lot of effort and work and partnership to get just even one or two positions available, and still not adequate hours available to be shared amongst the people on temporary assistance in the village, much less looking at a much larger population, since most folks in the villages are accessing Medicaid. I really applaud the effort to align with temporary assistance work requirements. I think it simplifies people's lives when they're on multiple programs, as well as the administration. There are pros and cons to this, though. The work verification requirements currently in place for temporary assistance mandated at the federal level make it prohibitively difficult to collect and verify that work has happened. I would argue that if there are work requirements and this does go forward, that you have a more liberal, flexible way and allow self-attestation for people doing volunteer and community work, as well as self-employment. Because ultimately, the collection takes so much work and effort in trying to get employers and supervisors at volunteer opportunities. People to do subsistence had to have somebody else not related to them verify that they went and did subsistence. So anyway, I'd say consider that closely and deeply, as well as on the upside, I'd like to note that there is an exemption for temporary assistance, exempt Native villages. Any village with unemployment over 50% is exempted from work requirements. I would urge you to include this specifically in the legislation if it does go forward, to ensure that the most rural villages with the highest, extreme high unemployment are exempted from this work requirement. And one last plug is to say that I love that there's exemptions for medical conditions and disability. However, what we find in rural Alaska is that there are no local healthcare providers. Trying to get to a healthcare provider to get verification and a doctor's note, what we found is instead of getting that doctor's note, we found folks just simply fell off the program. And these were the ones who were most in need of Medicare, the ones who have existing conditions but can't access a doctor. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here in the room in Juneau that wished to testify on Senate Bill 7? You want to come forth and state your name and affiliation, and you have about 2 minutes for your testimony.
My name is Honalee Elkon. I am a lifelong Alaskan. Sorry, I'm just going to pull up my notes here. I stand here opposed to the proposed bill SB 7 because I feel the bill will overburden people with even more paperwork for a service that already requires quite a bit of paperwork to qualify for. It will also create more paperwork for the departments that are going to have to handle this, who will have to process them, and this may speed the verification process, and this may also possibly then delay sensitive, time-sensitive, or life-saving medical procedures. As was mentioned, it sometimes may take up to a year for approval. This also may exclude people who truly need these services but might not fit the requirements that are currently proposed. Alaska is unique in many issues due to being such a large and diverse state, and we can't ignore the reality of the fact that this is one of the most expensive states to live in. Many of us are employed full-time and yet still require Medicare help to be able to afford medical things. And services like Medicare are pretty life-saving at times for some of us. if one of the goals of the state is to try and save money over the long view, there needs to be a conversation first about things like helping people find jobs, find employment, before we even start talking about limiting people's access to medical care, which can sometimes, you know, if they don't have that medical care, prevent them from even joining the workforce. Striking at the root cause, no jobs, inefficient unemployment assistance programs, et cetera, is what the state needs to spend time on before they start doing this kind of restrictions and limitations on who can utilize these medical assistance things. I think that's all I have to say, actually. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll go to the phone line, so the off-net. We'll start with Judy Eldridge, followed by Dana Redwood. Judy, if you can state your name and affiliate. Right?
Can you hear me?
Yes. You may begin your testimony.
Yes. Thank you so much for having this meeting. I appreciate it to the chairman and all the other members. I am going to testify in favor of this bill, and I'm going to give you the reasons why I think so. Medicaid has been around for a long time, and it was always clearly my understanding it was for the elderly, the disadvantaged, and young children that did not have anyone to care for them. I support that 100%, and that's what it should be. But when we expanded Medicaid, I testified against it because my concern was that many of these people that really needed it as we expanded it were not going to get the full service that they should because the money would be spread so thin. I actually see that happening in some instances where I know people that work with children that are very disabled. Their hours have been cut because they're trying to pay for everyone. Like Senator Stevens, I have worked since I was very young. I've never had trouble finding a job. And my husband and I are both over the age of 65, and we continue to work. And so I don't think there's any problem with raising it to 65. It is the new middle age. I have lived and worked in rural Alaska since 1997, and I will tell you that there in the school system, there are many, many jobs. They're available, and they cannot find people to actually work them. And I can give you some instances of that that I've seen over and over again. If you can volunteer instead of working, there, volunteer in a child's school. There are so many things you can do. And I guess that I don't know why we're still having this discussion when I thought it was settled in the 90s under President Clinton. I morally think that we should take care of the people that really have no one else to take care of them, but I also morally think that the state of Alaska should not be giving money to able-bodied people that are not working. And I think it has created a situation where I know in the villages that, well, I don't have to work because I'm getting care for. And I'm not saying that there's not many that do not need it, but I just think that the rest of us that have been working and working and working want to know, where does it end? Where do we require able-bodied people to work? And my goodness, it's only 20 hours a week. I just can't understand why anybody would be opposed to that.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Eldridge. Next, we'll go to Diana Redwood, followed by Amy Sawyer.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my testimony. My name is Diana Redwood. I live in Anchorage, and I am speaking on my own behalf. I am strongly opposed to this bill. First, I don't think that work requirements promote the core objectives of medical assistance, which is to help low-income people get medical services. A work requirement, it seems like it may lead to low-income people losing their health coverage and make it harder for people to get access. If I thought it would work, then great, but I've been looking it up, and there are several studies of work requirements, including under the TANF program, and they show that work requirements had little or no effect in increasing work or cutting poverty. In fact, the vast majority of people subject to the work requirement remained poor, and some became poor or lost their access to health services. the majority of medical assistance recipients are working, and given the exemptions, I wonder how many people would actually fall under this act, which thus seems even more punitive and unnecessary. So if we're trying to promote work and productivity in our state, I think there are better ways. If that is the purpose, then we should have programs that help boost education and skills or help provide child care for women trying to return to work, rather than simply requiring recipients to search for work or find a job. Otherwise, it appears as a state that we are just trying to increase bureaucracy to reduce people's access to health care, which I don't think is what being an Alaskan stands for. We help each other out and we contribute. So I think instituting the work requirements for medical assistance is the wrong way to go. Thank you for taking my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Wedowitt. Next, we have Amy Sawyer, followed by Andrew Cutting.
It's actually Amber Sawyer, A-M-B-E-R, for the record. And thank you for taking public testimony on this. I'm speaking on my own behalf. I would actually like to kind of address Senator Stevens' question. I myself actually worked until I caused a car accident September 1st, 2012, by having a seizure behind the wheel. I had not been diagnosed with epilepsy. I had a job at the time. I was coming from an event where I was volunteering, raising money for scholarships, and had a car full of people. I was the designated driver after the event that raised over $10,000 in approximately 3 hours. And when I went to the public health clinic, because my insurance at the event had not kicked in, or at my job had not kicked in yet, I had to meet with the only neurologist that the public clinic had outside of the clinic hours, because the clinic was so stressed by uninsured people and such, because my brain was sending out signals that could cause seizures every 45 seconds. And it has taken it took over 5 years for me to see 6 different doctors, including the epileptologist we only had in state for approximately 2 years, to get to Seattle to see doctors to end up having a brain surgery. For part of that time, I was on Alaska Medicaid and then Medicare. I'm now officially disabled, but it took me applying 3 times for that to happen, even with a mass in my brain that was approximately the size of an orange. It is not easy to get on Medicaid, and to become disabled, even when you have things that are diagnosed when you're working. I tried to work. As soon as people found out that I had a seizure, I literally was told to leave. I had over a dozen jobs in 2 years. And because I wasn't legally disabled, they had the right to do that.
And Ms. Sawyer, you're at 2 minutes. If you could wrap up your comments, please.
Okay. I was in a master's program. I literally had to leave class in an ambulance more than once. Now I've had brain surgery and I'm not allowed to work. These are the type of people you need to make considerations for. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Andrew Cutting, followed by Maude Blair.
Hello, my name is Andrew Cutting. I work for the Alaska Children's Trust, and I'm a program fellow. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on SB7. The Children's Trust is a statewide lead organization focused on the prevention of child abuse and neglect, and we value parents working. We know that the data clearly points out that dual-income families do better than single-income families. So we put a high value on that work. In fact, we had a webinar this week that brought in some national experts that talked about work requirements, and we looked at how they are being implemented in other states. And I would encourage you to check your email box. There's the slides and the recording of that information there. You know, one thing to look at as you compare it to other states is not just the number of people on the rolls, but what happens in the rest of the community. Oftentimes when the work requirements exclude people from services, they end up hitting the safety net. And what you see there is just a transfer of costs. So instead of paying the kind of low prevention cost that you see on Medicaid, you see an uptick in ER costs. And in a closed system like Alaska, we all bear those costs. Now, as we look to the system that Alaska would have to put in place to make this work, even if we assume that there was a zero cost on it, there's only so many people that would fit into these, right? So with the exclusions going on, you know, you have about 43% of the population, you know, working, and they're 19% working part-time. 6% are going to be in school. Another 11% will be taking care of either young children or older parents. And then there's a 15% number that's disability, which, again, this is a tricky number because there are lots of people who suffer from disabilities who don't have a clinical diagnosis. Village examples are you know, pretty typical here where there's not enough health care to give everyone the services to get a diagnosis, but they still can't work. So really, that leaves you a small percentage of the population. And even on the high side, you know, we could consider 10% aren't going to meet these requirements, which, again, in other states tend to kick out higher percentages. There's just not enough people on our system to make this a cost savings for the state. So even on the aggressive side, you're looking at maybe 9,000 people. And so the most kind of rough estimate savings you're looking at is around $4 million. And you know, what we know is that some states have spent more than $100 million putting this into place, and a number of states are fighting legal battles to push this through. In general,
Mr. Cutting, if you could wrap up your time.
Work is the way to make this happen, and I think we should look at the Montana model called HelpLink, and they actually increased their workflow from their Medicaid. So it's one state where they got more people working up and out of the system instead of down and out of the system.
Mr. Cutting, if you could wrap up your comments.
Answer questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Yes,
Senator Stevens.
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying that this program, if in place, would cost $100 million and save $4 million. Is that your testimony?
Mr. Cutting, are you still online?
$100 million was an example from Kentucky or Arkansas, and both of those states had a very aggressive model to remove people from the system, and that is not what we're looking at here. I would just encourage you to look at those states as an example of the sort of red tape and bureaucracy that was put in place to make some savings here. Again, Alaska is a different model, and our populations just have smaller numbers.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cutting. Next up is Maude Blair, followed by Josh Hemsworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Maude Blair, and I'm with South Central Foundation in Anchorage. I appreciate Senator McChicky commenting that he wants to build people up to make them be self-sufficient, and his comment that volunteering would help fulfill the requirement in places with few jobs, which is the true situation in a lot of our states. But South Central Foundation is opposed to this bill, and we echo many of the sentiments of Ms. Monk and Ms. Walker-Tolles. This is going to be a difficult bill to work with in rural Alaska. So just a couple of things that I would like to add to the discussion are many people who meet the work requirements may be removed from the rolls because they don't understand how to report it to the state and won't have access to a way to report their compliance. In much of the state, English is not the first language of people, and it's hard to explain concepts like this to them. And in a lot of places, there's no access to the internet. So there would have to be ways for them to report their compliance that way. And for Alaska Native and American Indian people, Medicaid services are 100% reimbursed to the state by the federal government. If you had another hurdle for Alaska Native and American Indian people to get Medicaid, they're just not going to apply for it, and that will reduce the amount of money coming into the state to help pay for health care. So that's all I would like to add at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blair. Next up, we have Josh Hemsworth, followed by Laura Reiner. Josh, if you could state your name and affiliation, and plan for about 2 minutes for your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Josh Hemsworth. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today, not only as a longtime Alaskan currently residing in Anchorage, but also as a volunteer board member of the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center. I'm here today to share with you about why I'm opposed to and my concerns with Senate Bill 7, But before I do that, I thought you might like an understanding of the landscape of healthcare services that support thousands of your fellow Alaskans. ANHC has been a much-needed asset of the Anchorage community for nearly 45 years, serving our first patients out of a trailer and now with over 80 staff members serving our community from our Midtown campus. At ANHC, 45% or just under half of our patient population pay for services using Medicaid. The average for the entire state is about 20%. So our patients are two times as likely to be covered under Medicaid than the average Alaskan. With that in mind, I want to share three key concerns I have with Senate Bill 7 and its companion in the House. SB 7's new employment-based eligibility requirements will decrease access to care, increase costs and complexity, and punish Alaskans with significant challenges. First off, SB 7 will decrease access to important health care coverage. As you've heard today, only the most vulnerable Alaskans are those that would be heavily impacted. You've learned today that somewhere between 180,000 to 210,000 Alaskans already participate in Medicaid. You've also heard that it's estimated that only about 25,000 Alaskans will be affected by this bill. And then beyond that, additional estimates from prior attempts show that three quarters of those individuals will qualify for the exemptions that are included in this bill, leaving only about 5,000 to 6,000 unable to qualify with these requirements. This is a new program, so it's hard to say exactly who those Alaskans are, but looking at the list of exemptions, these are likely individuals that work seasonal or temporary jobs that don't meet that weekly 20-hour requirement. And those Alaskans, as you can probably imagine, are the heartbeat of our tourism and fishing industries. You've also heard when vulnerable Alaskans with chronic health conditions have coverage, they're more likely to sustain employment, and then when they lose access to that critical care, daily life and work is that much harder. Next, SB 7's additional work requirements create more complexity and more administrative overhead. You've heard a lot of figures today around this. It's a major undertaking with little to no cost savings associated with it, even if you change it from a weekly to a monthly to an annual basis.
So Mr. Hamseth? Included,
the cost will be significant, and previous fiscal notes show anywhere from $300 to $500 million in first year operating costs to start this program.
Okay, Mr. Hamseth, if you could wrap up your comments.
Sure, absolutely. It's inconsistent with the priorities of many of the Senate and current administration to control and contain costs. You've also heard about the Montana model. And last, SB 7's work requirements punish Alaskans with significant illnesses and disabilities. The majority of Alaskan Medicaid participants are working, many in low-wage or seasonal jobs that don't provide coverage, and you've heard that there are multiple services with complicated pathways to assist them. And 5,000 Alaskans who would not be able to prove their exemptions are already those who struggle to navigate it, the complicated barriers facing them. Thanks for the opportunity to testify with you today.
Thank you, sir. Next, we have Alora Reiner, and then we're going to move to the Fairbanks LIO.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Alora Reiner, and I live in Kenai, and I am calling on my own behalf. And I'm calling, like many who have already spoken, to express some concerns about this bill that seems to add a lot of additional red tape to an already overburdened system, which could cause potential delays to folks who are seeking coverage for essential medical services. Several years ago, I was a Medicaid recipient for a period of time. While I was between jobs, I had been working a seasonal position that did not provide insurance. Just recently, I received a letter in the mail from the Division of Public Assistance. The letter is dated November 6, 2018, and it states that on November 22, 2016, my medical assistance application was received, and it is requesting some additional information from me. You'll notice there's nearly a two-year lag between when I submitted my application and when I got notification that it had been received and a request for additional information about that. So I think that many Alaskans, most Alaskans who are receiving Medicaid are working. Many are working in jobs that are temporary, seasonal, or low wage and do not provide health insurance. I don't think my situation is unique here. This two-year backlog may be longer than some, but I think many folks are experiencing a delay in a response. So my concern is that this bill and the requirements it proposes would add additional delays to a system that's already dealing with severe backlog and attempting to provide services to folks for essential medical care. So, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would ask this committee not to support the bill.
Thank you. Next in Fairbanks LIO, we have Rose O'Hara Jolly, followed by Haven Neville. Rose, are you with us? Okay. We'll see if we can come back to Rose. Maybe Haven Neville, if you're there in Fairbanks. All right, we'll try to come back down back to the Fairbanks LIO. We'll head to the Anchorage LIO and try for a Cindy Glatter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's Gilder, and I'm here on behalf of myself. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. I'm here to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 7. I can appreciate sort of philosophical where, you know, somebody who's perfectly capable to work, not using my federal tax dollars and limited state resources for their medical care when they could perfectly capable to work and they just want to stay home. I can appreciate that philosophy. But I have to question, based on the data, whether in fact we have a problem and whether this is the right fix. A 2017 study done by the Kaiser Foundation looked at non-elderly family work status, and being an engineer, no matter which way I slice the data, Alaska is one of the states where people are working. So just by comparison, they indicated non-work status for us was at 21%, and Maine, which is one of the states somebody earlier said had a program, is at 34%. So it sort of just has me scratch my head and say, okay, given the administrative burdens associated with this bill, which there will be significant, is this the right mechanism to help people who really need to want to get to work to get back to work? So thank you again for listening to my concern.
Thank you. We are running down on time. I know there's still about 20 or so folks still on the line to testify. We'll try to get through as many as we can today, just letting folks know that you can always go and email this us your written testimony at senate.hss@alaskaledge.gov. Next up is Betsy Odeman, followed by Eric Ramers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bessie Odom. I live in Senate District N, and I'm here to speak in opposition of Senate Bill 7. Now more than ever, we need a system that will provide for all Alaskans who are in need. We need to make services such as Medicaid easily accessible to anyone who is seeking the assistance. We are doing a disservice for folks who are in need if we continue to put more stipulations on a process that is already tiring and difficult. The process to apply for Medicaid is not one that is simple, but one that requires the potential recipient to navigate through a system that is overly complex. The conversation around assessing Medicaid and similar services should not be about more requirements, but the conversation should be about making access to Medicaid and other services easier for folks who are in need. This bill would exacerbate barriers to healthcare access already felt by Alaskans who are in need. By requiring Medicaid recipients to work or volunteer, what are we implying? I'm worried that this bill is implying that we have individuals dependent on the Medicaid program who are simply not willing to work or volunteer. This clearly is not the case, and we should not be assuming that this is the case. If the concern is that we are spending too much money on Medicaid, we should consider another option. Based off studies done in various states who are requiring Medicaid recipients to work or volunteer, it has been found that it is actually more expensive to implement the program. In a state like Alaska, where we're already short on funds, we simply cannot afford a program or a requirement in that matter that would end up costing Alaskans more than the system that is already in place. I'm asking you all on the Health and Social Services Committee to please reconsider supporting this bill and please oppose it. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Eric Ramers, followed by Mary Shellart.
For the record, my name is Eric Ramers, and I'm a policy coordinator for the Alaska Native Health Board.
and I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony on Senate Bill 7. Alaska's Medicaid program is a critical component of the Alaska tribal health system. Imposing work requirements would have systematic impacts across our system. The ATHS is a true system of care comprised of the voluntary agreements of 30 tribes and tribal health organizations. It is the most comprehensive health system in the state and one of the most comprehensive health systems in the country, and is critical to the Alaska public health system. For instance, Alaska Native health care organizations entered into an agreement with the Veterans Administration and the Department of Defense to increase access to care for both Native and non-Native veterans alike. Any adverse impact to the Alaska tribal health system reduces the state's ability to meet the health care needs of Alaskans across the state, especially our most vulnerable Alaskans. Alaska has the nation's highest unemployment rate and has been losing jobs since October 2015, which is 39 months and counting. This disproportionately impacts our rural communities. The Bristol Bay Borough, for example, has an unemployment rate double the statewide average and more than 3.5 times greater than the national average. Imposing work requirements in these rural communities will result in increased administrative costs, increased uncompensated care, and delays in care that will lead to more expensive treatments with worse outcomes. Work requirements will result in fewer enrollments or will cause those already covered to be removed from the rolls. This will greatly impact the Medicaid expansion population, which receives one of the highest federal matches. With fewer expansion beneficiaries enrolled, the state is leaving resources on the table for which Alaskans have paid and pay into with their federal tax dollars. As previously mentioned by Maude Blair with the South Central Foundation, the U.S. federal government has a moral, legal, and fiduciary responsibility for the health and well-being of Alaska Natives and American Indians. Therefore, they reimburse the state 100% for any care provided by Medicaid. ANHB is submitting written testimony that further details the system and statewide impacts of work requirements. In closing, many of the perceived benefits of adding Medicaid work requirements actually represents the loss in federal funding for the state at a time of economic recession. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next up is Mary Schollert.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mary Schollert, and I think I live in House District 28. I'm representing myself. Today I'm testifying opposing Senate Bill 7. I worked 15 years as a psychiatric outpatient mental health nurse, and my experience with working with the severely mentally ill people was sometimes they would have great days where you would think they could work forever, and sometimes they would have days where the only place that they could survive would be as inpatient mental health people at API. So the fact that you would want them to work, it just doesn't make any sense. I also have a sister with Down syndrome. She's currently 52 years old. She has early symptoms of Alzheimer's. She would love to work, and there is not any possible way that she could work. How are you going to assess each one of these individuals? Disability is an individual thing. Each person who has a disability it's unique and different. I mean, just listening to the testimonies, the different kinds of disabilities, it's astounding. And to put that extra requirement on people, I mean, I know enough about this vulnerable population to know that this is really a wrong Senate bill. Please oppose it. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go back to the Fairbanks LIO. For folks that are wondering, I just go in the time that they join the phone lines and try to take them in order. Next, we'll try Rose O'Hara Jolly. And Rose, do you have 2 minutes to testify? Hello? I apologize for the folks in Fairbanks. We seem to have some technical difficulties. We'll go back to the off-net folks, and we'll go to Catherine Bolak.
Yes, hi, thank you. I am representing myself.
If you could restate your name.
Yes, my name is Catherine Bolak. I reside in Chugiak, and I am strongly opposed to SB 7 for many of the reasons that have already been stated. But I wanted to add, Kathy Gusell was talking about Arkansas, and I have family and friends in Arkansas, and I've been following the work requirements there, and it's been a nightmare for many, many people. Over 17,000 people have lost their coverage there, not because they were ineligible, but because of computer glitches and lack of access or ability to navigate through the complex online reporting system. And I would really recommend to all those on the committee to refer to the McGonigal case, which is part of a lawsuit against the federal government that was taking place through the state of Arkansas. I also fail to see how this bill makes any sense at all at this time in light of the proposed budget cuts for FY 2020. If these budget cuts go through, it's going to be a major reorganization of an already understaffed and overwhelmed department, and I have serious doubts that it will be able to effectively deal with all of the individual cases that are going to come up, as well as the many, many appeals which will take place. Through the Walker administration was stated the implementation of this program would cost $79 million, so I'm not getting the differential between that and what was stated in this hearing today. So, where will this money come from except in lesser care being provided to those most vulnerable? Also to the state of Arkansas, people 50 and older are not required to
Ms. Bolak, if you could wrap up
requirements.
If you could wrap up your comments.
As someone who is over 50 and who is now a recipient of Medicaid, I was self-employed for many, many years. I paid into Primera Blue Cross, hardly had to use it because I was very healthy, but I got sick a couple of years ago, and I lost my business, and I never thought ever that I would need to use a program like Medicaid, and I have been...
Okay, Ms. Bolak, we're now going to move on to Mr. John Azada. John, if you could state your name and affiliation in about 2 minutes for your testimony.
My name is John Cezada. I'm the policy director for the Alaska Primary Care Association. We support operations and development of Alaska's 27 federally qualified health centers, and we are Alaska's primary care safety net provider that guarantees, access regardless of ability to pay. 35% of the patients that we serve are on Medicaid. We oppose SB 7 in its current form. We submitted a letter that outlines our concerns. The first point on which we are opposed is we believe the work requirements bill in its current form does not adequately encourage Medicaid beneficiaries to find and keep jobs. We are interested in the Montana Health and Livelihood Partnership that was mentioned earlier. We'd be happy to speak with bill sponsors and the department as it moves forward in considering this bill. Our second concern is that the loss of Medicaid coverage and corresponding access to treatment is dangerous to beneficiaries and patients and will also be expensive to the Alaska health system. We've outlined our concerns in that line, and they've been repeated by many other folks this afternoon. But suffice it to say that care that is provided without coverage is merely shifted to more expensive systems that include both emergency settings as well as the legal and correction systems. Number three, we strongly believe the state is currently ill-equipped to administer the program, that over 16,000 applicants for Medicaid still have pending applications. And then finally, we spend a lot of time in every one of our clinics supporting patients in gaining, understanding, and maintaining coverage. The churn that will be involved, especially in smaller communities with seasonal employment, will be profound for those patients as well as for the staff of the clinics that they serve. It will
Mr. Azada, if you could wrap up your comments, you're at your 2 minutes.
Yes, thank you very much. Again, we strongly oppose the bill in its current form. We look forward to working with the committee, and we thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Next up, and I'm going to apologize, the last name is Lopez Yala.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Sochi Lopez Ayala, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself. I am opposed to SB 7 in its current state. Senator Stevens, I urge you on behalf of your district to vote no on this bill. Being from a family that utilized low-income programs for health and social services, this isn't helping those who are still living and working to come out of poverty. With Dunleavy's proposed budget of slashing funding on many programs, we should be working towards helping Alaskans to find employment and better themselves financially. Rather, this bill is creating a job in itself to be on Medicaid and more paperwork for state employees who, again, are working on a slashed budget. These requirements for low-income people are just more hoops you're placing on many Alaskans to get access to health care. We should be improving easier access to the health care and workforce engagement, not create more barriers and obstacles to do so. So please, I am opposed to this, and that is all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Bethany Markham. Ms. Markham, if you could state your name and affiliation and plan 2 minutes for your testimony.
Bethany Markham, Anchorage with the Alaska Policy Forum. In 2017, the Walker administration projected that 23,273 able-bodied adults would enroll in Medicaid expansion at a cost of $7,500 per person. Actual enrollment in the expansion population in 2017 reached over 35,000 adults, and the cost per person was nearly $10,500. While it's true that the federal government is responsible for a portion of Medicaid expansion costs, it's not realistic to think our federal government will subsidize the program indefinitely. Since the well of public funding is not endless, able-bodied adults should not be prioritized over the truly needy who get traditional Medicaid. The solution for Alaska isn't more welfare, it's more work. Common sense work requirements for able-bodied adults can help Alaskans break free from the Medicaid expansion trap and regain their self-sufficiency while preserving state resources for the truly needy on traditional Medicaid. Research, which I would be happy to share with the committee, shows that work requirements offer enrollees a better future through the power of work. When work requirements were implemented in welfare programs, able-bodied adults leaving welfare found work in diverse industries and more than tripled their incomes, more than offsetting any lost benefits. Adding a common sense work requirement to Alaska's Medicaid program makes sense. We should be encouraging these able-bodied adults to move off the sidelines and back into the workforce, not the opposite. By implementing a Medicaid work requirement, we can emphasize the power of work to transform lives and break the cycle of dependency while preserving resources for truly needy Alaskans and shoring up our state budget for the future. Thank you.
Thank you. At this time, I just want to remind folks that they can always submit their written testimony to the senate.hss at akleg.gov. But that is our committee time for today. We will bring this bill back before the committee on Wednesday. We're going to set this bill aside. Are there any other comments from the bill sponsor today? Not seeing none. Are there any other comments from committee members? Seeing none, that concludes our business. The committee will not meet. The committee will not meet on Monday. We will keep public testimony open at this time, and so feel free to continue to send us those written comments. And we'll meet again on Wednesday to finish up SB 7. Thank you for attending, and we are adjourned at 3 p.m.